Would you introduce yourselves, please?
Well, hello, everybody. I am Ken Stringfellow.
And this is John Auer.
And okay. We are basically the Posies.
You met at age 13-ish. I think that you kind of either say 12 or 13, which means it was probably 12 and a half.
Well, I would say actually John was 13 and I was 14. I'm pretty sure that's accurate.
Oh, okay.
And I'm going to agree with Ken on that.
Well, you know, we can't have this whole thing where the two of you agree.
Oh, don't worry.
That won't happen long.
Yeah, it's not going to happen for long.
But I want to kind of get geeky from moment one. Every single conversation, well, you made your first thing on a homemade cassette and your dad had, you know, your dad was into music and there was a more sophisticated studio, right? But then I'm going back and I'm listening to that album on cassette, right? That was, quote, mastered on cassette. And people always say the cassette was like one of the worst mediums that mankind, you know, 1 7/8 inches per second, and you're dividing it up into four tracks into this little teeny thing. But let's get geeky. What kind of cassette deck did you actually have that you were able to? You must have known your Dolby and your Maxell XL2s. You must have known something a little bit.
Oh, yeah, I got to know it intimately. It's what kind of made our first record possible. Because like you said, we had this home studio at our disposal. It was my father who decided to take some money he inherited and turn our rec room into, you know, a place to make music, basically. He took the rec room was like the recording room. We had a laundry room for the control room. And he had, you know, some...
natural reverb if you put your head in the dryer.
In the dryer. We actually did right? that. We actually did stuff like that. We put amps in there and all sorts of stuff. Ken tried to put my head in there once, too. That's another story.
But that was a battle. That wasn't for reverb. That was for reverb.
We're still duking that one out. I mean, long story short, really, we had a small yet powerful studio at our disposal. And, you know, everybody has got GarageBand now and, on you know, can make records on your phones and stuff.
How many cassette decks did you have to bounce tracks back and forth?
Oh, you want to get straight to the cassette deck part. Okay, I'm getting the
here. No, you can go.
I'm just kidding. What I'm trying to say is we had like an 8-track analog. Like, this is a reel-to-reel analog studio.
Oh, you did?
Yes, we did. Okay, so here's what happened. But then we filled up all 8 tracks. So what we did was is essentially the Phil Spector trick, where you do like a submix of the 8 tracks of instruments. And I didn't have a working 2-track machine, so what was there to use? But it was a Pioneer cassette deck with DBX on it, is what it was.
With DBX, now that's really fun.
Yeah, and actually, the multi-track had DBX and the cassette deck. So we mixed all the instruments to 2 tracks. And then put it back on 2 more tracks, again through DBX, onto the 8-track. And then we did all the vocals, 6 tracks of vocals. And then I mixed it. Ken was going to come up for the mix. He was away at college. And one night, I just mixed it in about 6 hours. Because it was just, you know, the instrumental tracks were already mixed. So it was just vocals. So I did 12 songs from like midnight till 6 in the morning. And I called Ken the next day and said, hey, I just kind of did it. And that was that.
But you see, that's a huge difference from everything that I read, which is, oh, you made the album on cassette. There's a lot more to it than that.
Well, I think what they're accentuating is the fact that we released it as a cassette.
Yes.
I think that's more the point of the press that we got. People don't really know the technical end. But yes, we... At that time, CDs were still emerging, and we didn't really have a connection to know how to make them. Yeah. And LPs, not really either. They were kind of expensive or whatever. We didn't really have a...
So cassette was the thing.
Cassette seemed like the thing that was doable, and we bought blank cassettes.
So you bought those
town.
Bulk white cassettes that you can slap labels on. Oh, the clear ones,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, clear.
Right.
And then I was working at a record store, too. So actually, I would steal promotional cassettes. And some of the original cassettes that we made, if you actually, you know, our music would end and like, I don't know, Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch would come on at the end or something like that.
Or we'd have a promo cassette that was just a little bit shorter than the album. So the last song would just be cut in half.
Well, you know,
that.
If you really had the cheap tape, and I remember this because I used to do the same thing. You'd get the promotional cassettes and you'd say, well, I'm just going to save money and I'm going to record them. But it would bleed through.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, if it was really loud.
The first song we recorded for the Posies, it was Believe in Something Other Than Yourself. Was that the first full recording we did?
And that one we actually had the reel-to-reel 2-track to mix to.
That's true. Before it busted, before the kind of failed on that.
So there's used tape involved, and you can hear a folk singer that had been recorded, like, in about, let's see, dun, dun, dun.
Right there,
awesome. Little Joan Baez in the middle of the
you know, you're not wrong, actually. She don't think she wanted to be Joan Baez, so
every folk singer wanted to be Joan Baez.
A local artist, I suppose. Yeah,
I throw quotes out just because I like them. Mm-hmm. because I don't believe this now that I've just started talking to you. You are quoted as saying you're on more solid, I'll do it in the announcer voice, you're on more solid ground than you were at 25.
Sure. That's the idea, right?
Well, well, there's a lot of people our age, and I'm older than the two of you by a little bit. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people our age that are the polar opposite, that they got lost along the way. And you've had so many things happen. And again, you know, whether it's the loss of a close friend who was also a band member, I mean, all these things. So it's a good moment to say, what exactly is, you're still touring, you're still doing all of this. You put the band back together, you take it apart, you put it back. What is the motivation at this point? Is it still because there's still great songs out there and there's still an audience? I mean, what is when you wake up in the morning, what do you say? Because I don't know what I say these days. But
there could be great songs. We'll find out when we do some writing this year. And there is still an audience. I mean, it's not like it was at the peak of our career and we had all that promotional push happening 24/7. But obviously, it's sustainable, otherwise it wouldn't be sustainable and we wouldn't be here.
Sustainable's hard as a band overall. That's what today's bands kind of, when I talk to the youngins, and they're kind of like, well, we're making a living, and I'm like, but you're still living in your mom's house.
Is it like there's something wrong? Oh, wait.
No. Well, I still am. That's my, no, I'm just kidding. That's not my mom. That would be a problem. When you're saying, okay, we're the Posies and we're doing voicemails and we're doing all this stuff. Was it an opportunity to get creative? Did you kind of say, you know what? What the hell? Meet the fans? Or how do you decide how much you're going to put yourself out there to do all of this?
Honestly, I think that we were way ahead of the curve on that kind of thinking. I think we've always been very interactive. Long before there was any such thing as an internet, we had two-way communication with our audience. We did it the old-fashioned way with postcards, and we published our own fanzine, and we were in constant conversation with our audience back in the day. So actually, it's not really like a step off the mountain for us to do this kind of thing, and where maybe for some artists, getting used to this new paradigm of where the fans expect some quality time in some way or another, it might be a conundrum for some artists who didn't grow up with that, but we were that way from the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, before the days of, and you know, now there's Bandcamp. People can, you know, make their records and then put them up online. We just, you know, we didn't have that kind of access back then, but we still made the record and we found ways to get it out there. It just was a lot more of, you know, actual physical activity and hoofing and like going to stores and remember things like consignment? It's like, we did that. I mean, like 800 to 1,000 cassettes worth out of our backpacks, basically. Ones that we dubbed on the same cassette deck that we mixed the record on. And then we would, you know, we printed these covers and cut them up with X-Acto knives and folded them by hand. And that was 1,000 tapes done like that.
Thanks to our current generation, everything is a genre, right? You know, your shaving cream is a genre at this point. At least maybe yours isn't, but mine is. So it's kind
mine
of like...
Mine could be, I guess. Yeah.
But when you really think about 1993, when you said, oh, we're doing this, did you ever talk to each other, even when you were 13-ish, and say, you know, I mean, because obviously you loved certain bands and that got into the mix, as it always does, but how did it get to this?
That is an interesting question, especially when it's not that our view was really narrow when we started, because we did, considering the limited access we had in a sense, because we lived in a small town, we didn't have access to everything from the underground at all times. We listened to a lot of punk music and we listened to a lot of,
there was no grunge.
There was no grunge, but things like Throbbing Gristle or the Butthole Surfers or whatever that in their nascent early years at that time, and British punk, blah blah blah. We listened to
music. I mean, synth pop. I mean,
well, okay. So you've been quoted about that you did listen to a lot of goth too.
We listened to all sorts of stuff that we never would ever be given credit for because people wanted to find us.
But when we went for writing songs, it seemed to come out with a certain voice. I think by that time, maybe. Certain things like Husker Du, for example, that we loved, or The Replacements that we loved, they had coalesced from chaos into order.
Interesting.
And that's kind of where we found things that we liked. As far as like songs that had, you know, a well-crafted structure, seemed to be popping up in these other genres, and various genres, and that's what kind of sparked our interest, is a well-composed song. More than like I love the balls out aspect of even like The Who or something like that, or any punk band, whatever, but that the song is what's memorable.
Well, and in the end, I think, you talk about maybe us getting classified as the power pop group or a power pop group, and I think it also comes down to marketing, really, too. I mean, there's so many bands, I think, that actually could fall under that category more than us, that are considered other genres. Like, I think personally, and I know they came from a punk background, but I mean, Green Day, I mean, a lot of what they do, I think, is straight up could be like power pop. I mean,
absolutely.
But they will, they will always be known as a punk band because they came from, Gilman Street, and they have. It's also what's been propagated. But if you listen to their more recent stuff, I mean, they're doing. I mean, the Foo Fighters could be power pop. I mean, yeah. Husker Du could have been power pop, but no one ever calls Husker Du power pop because they come from a more aggressive and, like Cam was talking, the chaotic kind of background. I think it has a lot to do with where you start too. We started when we started getting attention. We were doing kind of very kind of more kind of clean, traditional kind of 60s pop, I guess. And that kind of, I think, stuck with us.
How do you kind of, as you're going to write new songs, do you ever think about remaining current? And is it relevant? And were you always current?
I think our ears personally are always open to whatever. I mean, if something sounds good to me, I'll check it out. I don't have any rules as far as what I'm going to listen to or not listen to like that, I don't know.
I will say that part of, when you're talking about motivation for getting out of bed, obviously if we were going to go back and make Frosting on the Beater part 2, I probably would pass.
Now that's interesting. Why?
Yeah. Because it's just I'm always interested in learning new tricks, I suppose, and I guess I'm bored easily in a sense, and I don't have the what music is coming at me, and I want to kind of go to where I'm not sure where I am, and that's kind of my typical compass setting.
Some bands have, I think, they've set a template for themselves, and that template's really good. I know Ken's used it before, this example, and I've used it too, but I mean, AC/DC, I mean, it's a great rock template, right? And yeah. they have set a standard, but do you really think you're going to be surprised when you go get the new AC/DC record? Probably not, and one thing I can say for sure with the Posies, if you really examine all of our records, I mean, every one of them is actually really different. There's nothing that sounds. I mean, the thread is the vocals and the production, the way they're dressed up, the moods, the things that we try. Every one of them is different. It's and especially when we were going back and doing all these reissues recently, it really struck me that we've never even come close to making the same record twice.
I was just thinking about something about how. Every time there's a Rolling Stones record released, it's always marketed as like the Stones are back to their form, always. And they do it every single one is released as if it's now a return to form. I've known that for the last 10 records they've done.
So there was RCA, there was SBK, there was Gary Gersh at Geffen. Did Gersh just actually, was he the guy who actually sat down friendly-like and got it, even though he was with Geffen?
Yeah, I mean, Gary, I think, was... we were really fortunate that, he found us, really, because we were going to going down another road, actually, like you mentioned, SBK, and there was another guy who was really courting us for quite a while. In fact, we did demos for him and whatnot, and we went to New York to visit them and whatnot, and I believe it was their legal department, that's what they said, was kind of, taking their time getting stuff together, and they didn't really seal the deal with us. And in the time, I think there was also something that I think Gersh had read this review. Did he not read the review that was in Cashbox? I think Cashbox magazine back in the day. This wonderful guy named Joe Williams is no longer with us, who ended up, giving this incredible glowing review to this, in this major trade magazine. And that got a lot of attention for us. And luckily for us, Gary kind of swooped in before the SBK folks could seal the deal. And it was kind of a no-brainer for us. Mm-hmm. Geffen. I mean, and first of all, we were obsessed with XTC, but also just, you've got Peter Gabriel, you've got Kate Bush. I mean, they were obviously an incredible label in David Geffen's history, yada, yada, yada. And Gary, he was cool. I mean, he even saw us in some pretty podunk circumstances playing music and still wanted to sign us. He came up and saw us play in Seattle at a food festival, and he just wanted to. I think he liked the fact that he liked our songs and he liked us. He liked that we could sing and that we were about songwriting. He kind of,
but it comes
know,
right
took a chance on us because I think he thought we would you know, we were headed somewhere.
In 1994, your message to the world, I'm doing this in the Casey Kasem voice, mm-hmm. your message to the world was free Tibet.
Oh, yeah, we did do some free Tibet.
In 94, when somebody asked you what your message to the world was, it was free Tibet. What's your message to the world now?
Impeach Trump.
There's a million myriad things to write about. That's not a problem. That's never been a problem. I think as you get older, one of the benefits, however, is that you can get out of navel gazing and get into a broader view of things and look into subjects that are around you rather than just, oh, I'm so sad because you didn't like me, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that's one of the things about hearing our old records now, too, that I've noticed is, like, I realize, you know, it's still me, like, back then, what I'm listening to, but it's a very different and, you know, more an existential crisis kind of mode, I think. And that can, of course, you know, some of the best stuff, some of the best songs comes from that, I think. But, you know, I don't think, you know, the older you get and you can't use that as fuel forever. You know, you have to find other things to kind of fuel the fire than your you know, your angst and, you know, working through stuff. Hopefully you get to a point where you work through some things and you kind of like write about things from other angles and find something new.
So I invented a thing called a musical sandwich.